homosexuality, basically support for gay marriage in different parts of the country, in every state of the United States. And he found that, using surveys, and he found that there are large differences in support for gay marriage with, in the most tolerant places such as Rhode Island, about 60% of people support gay marriage. And in the least tolerant parts of the country, such as Mississippi, only about 20% of people support gay marriage. So huge differences in tolerance in the United States, as can be seen in this map here. Next, I want to compare tolerance to the size of the openly gay male population in that area. And we have three now measures of the openly gay male population. The first two have been around for a little while now. First is just surveys. Gallup does a survey and asks in every state measures of homosexuality. There's also the census, which measures domestic partnerships, same-sex versus opposite-sex in every state. And then there's a novel one, and I think even the most powerful one now, which is Facebook profiles. So I'll talk a little bit about that. When you sign up to Facebook, they ask you both your gender and what gender you're interested in. And about 50% of people answer this question, so we can basically, and a large percentage of people now are on Facebook and across every demographic in every part of the country. So we can ask, what I did is I divided of men who say what gender they're interested in, what percent say they're interested in men. And I found out that there are huge differences in the size of the openly gay population according to Facebook. On the x-axis here, we have the measure of tolerance that I discussed earlier, what percent of people support gay marriage. And on the y-axis, you have percent of males on Facebook, of males on Facebook who say what gender they're interested in, what percent say they're interested in men. And you can see, on the scale of social science, this is a pretty overwhelming relationship. It's both statistically significant and quantitatively meaningful. So in the least tolerant parts of the country, like Mississippi, where only about 20% of people support gay marriage, there's only about 1% of males say they're gay. And in the most tolerant parts of the country, where about 60% of people, or 50 to 60% of people support gay marriage, California, D.C., Rhode Island, about 3% of males are openly gay. So about a 3% larger gay population in the most tolerant parts of the country, openly gay population. So now there's kind of, this is, again, you get kind of similar relationships, although not as strong. I think this data is more powerful for a lot of reasons. One of them, just the overwhelming sample size. We're talking about millions and millions of profiles, whereas Gallup survey is only a couple hundred people sometimes. So you get a really sharper relationship, but you would see a similar pattern if you used Gallup polls or if you used census data on same-sex couples. So now the question, and I think it has been an open question, is what's driving these differences? And I think there are theoretically two things that can be going on here. One is gay males, gay mobility. Gay males are moving out of intolerant parts of the country, such as Mississippi, into places like Rhode Island, California, D.C. And the second is these differences are driven to some degree by the closet. So people in even if Mississippi or Rhode Island had the same number of men attracted to men, more men would be open about this in the more tolerant parts of the country, such as Rhode Island, than Mississippi. And Facebook data actually allows us to break this down, because Facebook includes, unlike a lot of data sets, the place where someone is born, someone's hometown. So this graph's a little confusing, and I don't want to probably take a little too long to explain, but I basically, for every state, I calculate the percent of gay males born in that state, not just the percent of gay males living in that state now. And it turns out that there definitely is gay mobility, not surprising. Gay males do, on average, tend to move. If you're born in a less tolerant part of the country, gay males are likely to move to more tolerant parts of the country. But we can calculate it, and it explains less than half of the differences in the openly gay male population. So it's something, but definitely not everything, far, far from everything, in fact. So even if you did state of birth, there would still be large differences in the gay population. So many fewer gay males born in places like Mississippi than places like Rhode Island. And I want to argue now that since we've kind of calculated the first theoretical possibility, the second possibility looks a lot stronger, that a big part of this difference is basically the closet, that men are less open about their sexuality in these less tolerant parts. Another piece of evidence that mobility is not explaining everything is we can limit the analysis just to the high school population, because high school men tend to live where their parents choose to live, not where they choose to live. So it kind of eliminates the mobility factor. And you see, again, a very strong, statistically significant and meaningful relationship. In Mississippi, the kind of bottom left corner, it's perhaps shockingly small. Only 0.1% of males in Mississippi say they're interested in men in high school, which is a really small number. I was kind of surprised by how small that is. In the more tolerant parts, it's more like 2% of males in high school say they're interested in men. So I think what the Facebook data tells us is that a lot of the differences aren't differences in the true population, they're differences in degrees of openness. And we get actually another piece of evidence for this using another big data source. And this, I need to emphasize, is anonymous and aggregate data. It's just putting together everybody's searches. So what I did is I calculated of pornographic searches on Google, what percent of them are looking for gay male pornography. So these are searches like gay porn or searches for a particular gay male porn site, such as a site like RocketTube, which is just depictions of gay males, or perhaps a depiction of a particular gay male porn star, you know, asking to see him nude or in films. And this actually is a statistically significant relationship, although you can't see it. There is actually a higher percentage of pornographic searches are gay in the more tolerant parts of the country. But you can see this relationship is not that strong, and it's much smaller than the differences in the openly male gay population. So in places like California, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, the most tolerant parts of the country, about 5.2 or 5.3% of pornographic searches are looking for depictions of gay males. In places like Mississippi, Arkansas, the least tolerant parts of the country, about 4.6, 4.7. So a lot closer than the differences in the openly gay male population. And of course, the obvious advantage of this data source is it's anonymous, it's private, people are in their own home, even though this is, of course, aggregated, we don't know what anybody's doing, but people we think are gonna express their true desires here. So the true desires says there's about 5% of men are gay everywhere, whereas the openly gay male population differs much more in different parts of the country. This kind of sums up what I found and the different pieces of evidence. So we first started that there are huge differences in the size of the openly gay male population, with much more openly gay males in more tolerant parts of the country. Facebook says that less than half of this is due to mobility, and data from high school students on Facebook supports this conclusion. And we found that the differences are far smaller among pornographic searches on Google. And I think you put all that evidence together, you see that there are a lot more closet gay men in less tolerant parts of the country. There's actually, I think, more evidence for this. Let me start with, this is kind of my favorite piece of evidence. This is kind of the thing, it's like, where else are you gonna get data like this, right? Like, this is, when I say like that there's a new data source that like, and I'm trying to like preach to the choir, like I'm trying to preach to everybody, like really, this data source is amazing. I think this is like really the best evidence for it. So this is searches that include the words, is husband gay? So it's searches like, is my husband gay? I think my husband is gay. My husband just told me he's gay. How do I know my husband's gay? Searches like that. Very, very, very common search. Of all searches that start, is my husband, gay is the most common word. 10% more common than, is my husband cheating? 9 times more common than, is my husband depressed? And you can imagine that women might, you know, not always, but where there's smoke, there's fire here, perhaps, in the sense that you might think that women get some clues, either, you know, a less than satisfactory sex life, or perhaps they've walked in on something that gives them a reason to suspect that. And you see, I mean, overwhelming relationship that these searches are far more common in places with less tolerant attitudes towards homosexuality, where I said, where the other analysis is saying there are more men in the closet. So one more, I think this is kind of directly related to this conference, perhaps the most directly related to this conference, and this is not as strong a relationship, but there still is a relationship, is I also looked at, I went to Craigslist, and on Craigslist you can advertise for casual encounters, and that's basically you're looking for basically sex, anonymous sex. It's different from the kind of, Craigslist also has a dating site where it's more long-term relationships, or you're looking for a partner. This is you're looking for anonymous sex. And there are ads for both men looking for women and men looking for men. So I downloaded for every state, I went through the site, and I downloaded how many ads of men looking for a particular gender, what percent are looking for men. And you see, again, not as overwhelming as the is husband gay, but I don't think there's really any data that's as overwhelming as that in all my years of social science. But this is a significant relationship, and you do see that there do tend to be a higher percentage of these ads are looking for men in less tolerant parts of the country. So I think you're kind of getting a picture of what we're talking about here, and it's probably not the what most people would consider ideal or the healthiest treatment homosexual lives in these parts of the country, where you see in parts of the country where intolerance is high, you still see a lot of men in the closet. They're not open about their sexuality. They're not acknowledging their sexuality on social networks. They're not dating on dating sites. I also look at that in a different place. They're not looking for long-term relationships. They're not in long-term relationships according to census data. And many of them, you know, the data from Is My Husband Gay searches perhaps are married to women. And instead of kind of looking for being in relationships or looking for kind of long-term partners, we're seeing looking for anonymous sex on Craigslist. So that kind of puts together all these different data sources and gives a sense of what I think is going on in the less tolerant parts of the country. You have to make some assumptions to put kind of numbers to it, but I think the overall evidence that I put kind of calculating this a whole bunch of ways, I think about 5% of men are primarily attracted to men, and they're only about half as likely in the United States, throughout the United States now, to acknowledge their sexuality on social networks. And then in the least tolerant parts of the country, at least 50, perhaps as much as 80% of gay men remain deep in the closet. I mean, this is we're talking about married to women or, you know, anonymous sex on Craigslist. So it remains a big issue in the United States. And then, again, going back to the two main points I want to emphasize, lots of closet gay men, particularly in less tolerant parts of the United States, still a big issue. And then the second point, which I think is even more important, so I'm not, as you kind of guess, I'm not a STD researcher. So thank you again for having me, despite my complete lack of expertise in this area. But I am an expert on new data sources. I've been using a whole bunch of these data sources, Facebook profiles, Craigslist, Google searches, dating sites. I think we're really getting a remarkable window into humans that we haven't had before. And, you know, just going back to Anne's talk on STDs and the survey analysis was all fascinating. But at some point, you're kind of like men paying for sex, acknowledging in a survey, well, I want to see Google escort searches on that. It's a different way of looking at the question, and it's not a survey, so it's kind of harder to translate directly into this means 10% of men are looking at escorts. But I think they can be combined, really, in interesting ways. And I think they are kind of a new source for when you're talking about these really sensitive issues that a lot of people in this room are specializing in. You know, STDs and sexual behaviors. It's really an exciting time to be a social scientist with this anonymous aggregate data, and I think it's really untapped at this point. So more information on these data sources and kind of how I do these analyses are on my website. So I invite people to go to the website, and I guess now Anne and I are going to answer questions about our talks. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to both our speakers for excellent, quite different, but excellent talks. And so now open to the floor for questions, comments, observations. So please come to the mic. There's four microphones. Yes.
Yeah, I'm Susan Rosenthal. I just have a comment for Seth. I would encourage you, given our concern about young adolescent boys, to do the search of is my son gay, and look at that compared to high school, and really see if you can't use this as a way to advocate for our young men in intolerant states. Thank you.
Sevgiaral, CDC. This is really interesting. I can't see either of the speakers from this mic. It's almost a very experimental kind of thing. Thank you both very much. Those were really exciting, wonderful presentations. Seth, thank you. That was wonderful. I just have a very, just out of curiosity, personal question. Did you look at any STD maps of the United States and kind of compare in your mind's eye your tolerant, intolerant states and where we have huge STDs?
Yeah, so thanks. It's a good question. Thank you for the comment about is my son gay, which is also a very, very common search, as the questioner suspected, and I think is another interesting phenomenon, definitely. So I did look at it, actually. Stephanie knows we were talking about this beforehand, so I probably wouldn't have thought to do that, but I did do it just because she suggested it. And it does seem like if they do map both the STD maps that probably you've seen, southern parts of the United States, and also intolerance. So I think that's definitely an area to look at, whether kind of what we can learn that we wouldn't know from the surveys as well. On the STDs in different, and whether we can directly connect this closeted behavior to STDs, I think it's going to be another interesting
thing. Hi, my question is also for Seth. I'm Christina Schumacher from Johns Hopkins. I was really fascinated by the methodology and looking at the Google searches and how you're using that data to understand what people are doing. And I was wondering if you had thought about applying that type of methodology to better understanding what's going on with mobile dating apps like Grindr, so when people are in a bar and how they're using it, if there would be a way to track usage so we could better understand how those things are happening.
I think these are all good ideas. I think there's no shortage of ideas here. So, I encourage if you have an idea, just go with it. It's really low-hanging fruit as far as these things. So I haven't looked at that.
Thank you for the presentations. I'm Heidi Bauer. I'm from California. And I was listening to the presentations, and Seth, sorry to put you on the spot. It's easy to look at what you've done and I think draw the conclusion that stigma really does play a powerful role. And if you do look at the maps together, I think you see some obvious convergence. But it's ecological. And I'm wondering how would you approach, as a social scientist, looking at whether stigma in healthcare settings is creating barriers to care, whether, you know, homophobia, all those things that we think have a role in both risk and access to care might be accessible via the data systems that you have.
Yes. Yes, so one thing is this data is going to remain anonymous in aggregate, so that's really important. I mean, you can imagine we're talking about some sensitive stuff here, and I think it's really important to have researchers have access to this, but also to protect everyone's privacy. And that does limit what you can do with it. I think there is potentially more that can be done also at the city level, where you might be able to compare it more to hospital data. You can still keep the data anonymous and aggregate and look at town by town or city by city analysis of some of these sites. And I don't know. Again, it's not my expertise. I do want part of this talk is to encourage other people to use this data and to do these analyses where they have this expertise. So I wouldn't even know where to begin on measuring hospital, anything about hospitals and care, anything basically. So I would encourage other people who have this expertise to look into these types of questions and to use some of these, compare some of these new data sources to some of the data sources that you're more familiar with.
Thanks. There was an excellent mini plenary earlier on the use of big data, and I think a lot of this could come together. Yes.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Starris from the University of Florida, and Seth, you can tell we're all really excited about your data. But as an epidemiologist, the question that comes to my mind is, which happened first? Were the openly gay men out there, and that caused the tolerance in the city, in the areas, and can you look at that at all with your data sets?
Yeah, so that's, I think, a good question. It's also, I think, one of the advantages of this data set is that because the data points, you know, we're talking about millions of data points, you actually can get meaningful information over time in pretty good numbers, which can be hard with surveys where you have to do it, you know, to get like how a small city's behavior is changing over time. You can't really do with you can do maybe with one survey, but you can't do it for every city. So I think another good idea. So I encourage somebody to look into that.
Hi, Anne O'Leary from CDC. I'm kind of expanding on Sevgi's comment about where the STDs are, because there are a lot of things that are in those intolerant areas, including, you know, STDs, including percentage of the population that's African American, and accompanying cultural factors there, and poverty. You know, there's lots of things that cluster in those same areas, so it's just something to think about.
Hi, I'm Martina Akra from the University of Rochester in the Monroe County Health Department. I'm actually originally from Ghana, West Africa, and I noticed that the question on Facebook, a lot of people from Ghana, actually, when they ask that question, they select both male and female, so their interpretation is different. So in this context where where the data is being used to determine, you know, heterosexual or homosexual relationships, I'm wondering how the question can be phrased differently for people who may interpret it. You know what I mean? Like, how does Facebook change that question so that's culturally appropriate, I guess is what I'm trying to get at. If you have any ideas, both of you.
Yeah, so I think it's a good question. It's actually, so one of the natural questions is why did I limit this to men, not women? And there are two reasons for this, actually. The first is that, the first actually is exactly related to this, where if you see the percentage of women who are interested in women, like a very high percentage of women say they're interested in men and women, which either means like bisexuality is way more prevalent than we realized, or my interpretation is that it's less of a loaded, in the United States, it's less culturally loaded to say that, and maybe people are thinking about friends and stuff like that. But with men, it seems like the numbers are so low and that it doesn't seem like people, and there's such a kind of a, there seems to be something saying you're interested in a man, saying you're interested in a man that gets some attention, that it's not, it's more reliable in that way, but it's interesting, yeah, different countries, whether that's different. Yeah, and then I don't know as far as like, it would be great if Facebook, like, you know, saw the research value in this and changed and like kind of collaborate with researchers on asking the questions in ways that would be more helpful.
I just wanted to abuse the chair and make a comment on that, which is my son, and just talking to Anne about it, Anne's daughter, the children that we know, who are on Facebook and who've been on Facebook, but they don't necessarily say what's actually true on those things. And there is a particular thing of children, my son anyway, who says he's married to a boy at school and has been for 3 years. And I think it's just, I think, you know, there's a lot of cultural differences about how you answer that question, about whether you, because it does kind of, what are you interested in? It sounds like a dating site, and if you read it like that, you may want to say, what's that got to do with
me?
It's
a joke, actually.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's a joke question. So I think you have to, and I think that the questioner is very right. It's probably very culturally different in different different age groups, different settings, different contexts. Right, we have time for a couple more questions. Yes.
Okay, so slightly different kind of a question to you, Seth. Obviously, you know, an audience like this has lots, you know, lots of expertise and lots of questions to ask. However, you know, Google has all the data, or Facebook has all the data, but they are not necessarily interested in answering all these questions. Some people like you are. The thing is, how does this, so two questions. First of all, in how much of the data that you used, was it the fact that you were at Google and therefore you had access to some internal data? And secondly, how can this audience access that data and start asking the literally thousands of questions that this audience has, which will all benefit society, because you obviously don't have the bandwidth to do so?
Yeah, so this data is actually all publicly available. Google Trends is where you can get data on what people search, and also Google AdWords. There are some limitations of the data where you kind of have to do what I call a hack to get better data, but I explain that on my website. And then the Facebook data is their, I don't work at Facebook, so that's just their advertising platform. You can go to their advertising platform and they say, you can say like how many men are interested in men in any city or high school students or, you know, anything else. So.
Okay, because of time, I'm going to ask the next, there's three more people. I'm going to say quickly make your points and then we'll ask the speakers to wrap up.
Right. Thanks very much to the both of you for great presentations. I'm Dan Wolfeiler from the California Department of Public Health. My questions are, what's either been your favorite use of your data, or in your mind's eye, what would you love to see come out of your data?
You're going to have to, I want all the questions because we haven't got time.
Okay. Hi, Nicola Lowe from University of Bern. I've got a question for Anne, which links into the big data stuff. Did Natcell ask about internet use and use of social media? So are you able to look at sexual behavior in users and non-users and maybe look at some of the biases that you get out of the big data analyses from those data sets?
Hi, Harlan Rotblatt, Los Angeles County. So I have a question for Anne also, which is, I think I misunderstood the slide about, there was a question about chlamydia testing or chlamydia diagnosis. Yeah. But I was wondering if there was a question about chlamydia testing or diagnosis, if there was a clear impact on some of the program inputs that have happened in the UK around making chlamydia testing more available.
Okay, fine. So I'll do that in reverse order, I think. So we got the questions on chlamydia testing. There was a question asking whether people had been tested and when was the last time, and then whether or not they'd been diagnosed positive and when was the last time. So we were able to chart the uptake of testing. So I'm sorry about the very complicated slide, but that was basically showing on the right-hand axis the proportion tested, and then there was the proportion diagnosed. So it was about 50% the highest tested, and then about, I can't remember, about 4% who'd actually been diagnosed. So those were the questions asked. So we are able to look at uptake of testing in relation to sexual behaviour. And there we found that actually there was some evidence of higher risk people being tested, which is sort of good. But actually, interestingly, although we get similar areas of rates of testing in areas of social deprivation, the prevalence was higher. So we weren't really keeping up with the social deprivation in relation to the prevalence, if that makes sense. And then Nikki's question was, do we have questions on internet use? And the answer to that is yes, but probably, dare I say it, they're not quite good enough, and we'll do better next time, because when we designed the survey, of course, you know, we're never quite up to young people who just move on very fast. But yes, we do have data on, and we've just done some analyses on people seeking services on the internet. We also have data which is unanalyzed on people seeking partners on the internet, and I think that will be very interesting. And we have data on people getting information from the internet, sex education on the one hand, but obviously sort of, you know, sex websites as well, which are not sex education, more pornographic websites. Okay. And your question is, what's my favourite use of the data? I think it has to be something like the use of the data to justify lowering the age of homosexual consent. Because we did all this for reasons of sexual health services, which is great, but it's the things that we didn't think that it might be useful for that seemed to me so important in kind of people's frankness, openness, and better understanding, because that's for me what these data are about. They're not just about services. They're about what people do. They look themselves up on the graphs, because it's all about, you know, what is, it's about am I normal? Somebody said it yesterday. And the description of people not having a lot of sex, there was a kind of collective sigh of relief in the media, I would say, when people discovered that actually, you know, life does change, and when you get older, things are different, and so on and so forth, and that everybody, anything goes, and there's a lot of more tolerance of actually a much wider variety of sexual practices and lifestyles. But most importantly, I think, in a way, society is becoming, at least in Britain, more worried about relationships which are not respectful, and I think that's something that perhaps we should be trading on more. Thank you.
Okay, I want to thank both of our speakers for fantastic presentations, to you for the questions and the great session. Thank you.